This Israel Report is brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you are based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.
The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Boker Tov, good morning. How are you?
Boker Tov, Tu Bishvat Sameach. Of course, Tu Bishvat, besides being the tradition of eating the various fruits or partaking of the various fruits, there's also the tradition of rebuilding and replanting and regenerating. And, of course, being the new year of the trees, and, of course, this year it has some increased significance because there's a huge effort that's been going on to try to mark Tu Bishvat by rebuilding the South, replanting the South, forests being replanted in order to regenerate the damage that was done to the South. And this is a Tu Bishvat that we hope will mark a new beginning and a regeneration of the damage. Unfortunately, it's only physical because mental damage is very, very difficult to eradicate in one Tu Bishvat. But I do wish everybody Tu Bishvat Sameach. Let's hope that we can begin the rebuilding and regeneration process. And, you know, we still are getting a lot of information coming out from the released hostages and lots of harrowing stories about their experiences in Hamas captivity. But there are also some amazing survival stories, incredible survival stories. And Ran Gilboa, who is the father of Daniela, one of the soldiers, the lookout soldiers who was kidnapped and has returned back to Israel, was telling some stories that he had gathered from Daniela since her return. He gave an interview to one of the Israeli papers. And the thing that really caught my attention was the story about the girls when they were together learning Arabic while they were in captivity. But they were learning Arabic in a way that their captors didn't know that they were understanding and learning the language.
Wow.
How do you do that?
Wait, so
how
they weren't learning it. They weren't learning it because they were being forced to. They were learning it deliberately so that they could understand their captors.
Correct. They were learning it of their own volition, their own initiative, so that they could understand a little bit more about what was going on around them. And they managed to conceal that somehow from the people who were holding them, that they were learning and understanding more and more of what was going on around them, which I think is an incredible achievement, something really worth thinking about, and just goes to show the survival instincts that come out and the strength that these girls really had while being kept in captivity. It's just inconceivable that you can be kept in such dire conditions. Daniela also said that they went some time without any water at all, and so they were forced to drink water from the floor. They found damp areas on the ground, and in order to hydrate themselves, they were drinking water from the floor, and as a result of that, she became incredibly ill, and it was claimed that she was on the verge of really vacillating between life and death from the illness that she suffered. She somehow, again, managed to summon those survival instincts and overcome that illness. It's not clear whether she was treated or not, but she was very, very significantly ill as a result of having to drink water from the floor. So these are just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the stories that are coming out from the tunnels of Gaza. And there's a lot more to be told. And I'm guessing there's some sort of a movie in the making here, because I don't think that we can really get a proper indication, a proper feeling of exactly what went down in the atmosphere that they were being held in. Lots of videos that have come out also being released by Hamas, ironically, about some of their time in captivity. But of course, we will throw some little snippets in from time to time. I will throw them in as they become known to me, just little bits that I think might be interesting, because it's impossible really to try to cover all the details. Yeah. And of course, we have the visit of American Secretary of State, new American Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who will be visiting the Middle East over the weekend and will also be stopping in Israel. So we will await that with some expectation to see what it is that he has to say. Clearly, the new U.S. administration and Marco Rubio in particular, very much pro-Israel, very much hardline in terms of insisting upon Israel's rights. And so it'll be fascinating to see how that visit goes down.
The King Abdullah of Jordan met earlier this week with President Trump at the White House. What do we know about this meeting?
Well, I think there are a few things that are worth mentioning about the meeting. The first of which is that King Abdullah became the first Middle Eastern leader to meet with President Trump at the White House. And I think that that was also the case in President Trump's first term in office. I think it was exactly the same situation where King Abdullah was the first Middle Eastern leader to meet, obviously not counting Prime Minister Netanyahu, who already had an opportunity to meet with President Trump a couple of weeks ago, but King Abdullah was there this week. Interestingly, the Egyptian President al-Sisi was supposed to have met with President Trump next week, but he has decided to delay his visit in light of the current Gaza plan that has been put forward by the Trump administration. And King Abdullah's visit comes against the backdrop, first of all, of the fact that America really finances Jordan in a very substantial way, and not only finances Jordan, but also by extension, finances the survival of the Jordanian royal family. So King Abdullah needs to play a very, very cautious game here in terms of, on the one hand, standing up for the Palestinians, because he's seen to be something of a representative, a spokesperson on behalf of the Palestinians. And it's somewhat ironic that that is the case, but that is the way he is seen, because he is also the head of the Waqf, the religious council that governs over the Temple Mount, the Islamic religious council that governs over the Temple Mount. So the King of Jordan has a certain standing within the Muslim community as the head of the Waqf, and therefore the governor of the holy sites of Jerusalem, including the Temple Mount, including Al-Aqsa. And of course, he went along to the White House, I suppose, with two main agenda items. Agenda item number one is to ensure continued funding from the United States. I have little doubt that that would always be top of the agenda. But of course, agenda item two was to somehow show his own constituency, and particularly the Palestinians and the rest of the Islamic world, that he is willing to stand up to President Trump in order to protect Arab and especially Palestinian rights. Now, on the one hand, King Abdullah's wife, Rania, comes from a family of Palestinians, and she's been very, very vocal in supporting the Palestinian cause. On the other hand, we also remember that there are something like 2 or 3 million Palestinians currently living in Jordan, most of whom do not have naturalized rights. They've been there, many of them descendants of people who were refugees in 1948. And Jordan has also helped UNRWA and other organizations to perpetuate this notion of refugees in Jordan. So they don't have naturalized rights, and they are always considered to be there temporarily pending their return to something which really doesn't exist any longer. But interestingly, it was King Abdullah's namesake, his grandfather, who was killed by a Palestinian gunman. So the Hashemite royal family in Jordan have a very mixed relationship with the Palestinians. On the one hand, perpetuating their temporary nature and their refugee status in Jordan. On the other hand, he himself marrying a Palestinian lady and also being seen as the representative, as the head of the Waqf and the representative of the Jerusalem holy sites, and therefore having a certain obligation to present the Palestinian side to President Trump. And of course, his meeting comes exactly on the back of the announcement of President Trump's Gaza plan, which King Abdullah is incredibly opposed to, because the last thing that he needs right now is another million Gazans to come and join the temporary refugees, our Palestinian community exists in Jordan. That could potentially even outnumber him in a significant way, and could potentially even destabilize his rule over Jordan, because the Palestinians may well decide, as they did against his grandfather, to somehow rise up against the royal family. So he's stepping on a very, very thin line in terms of balancing between one constituency and another. He did, interestingly, while opposing the Gaza plan, offer to take 2,000 sick Gazan children into Jordan for treatment. How exactly that's going to be facilitated and work out is unclear to me, but at least for the headlines, that was what he was offering. He's clearly opposed to the Gaza plan. And Al-Sisi, the Egyptian president, decided, because he was so opposed to the Gaza plan, he's not even willing to come to the White House next week as planned in order to meet with President Trump. That's him
putting up his boundaries and
saying, incredibly. And I think that a lot of that is to do with the way that he needs to present himself. Let's remember that Al-Sisi is opposed to the Gaza plan also mostly because the last thing that he needs in his business is a whole group of Palestinians coming to live in Egypt. That is the last thing, because Egypt is relatively free of refugees. And by bringing large numbers from Gaza, the question is, how does Egypt treat them? Will they become refugees in the same ways UNRWA would want them to be, a kind of refugee from generation to generation? Or will Egypt be expected to normalize and naturalize that group of people in the fullness of time, and thereby creating a potential political stumbling block, even more than a stumbling block, a potential political pitfall for Al-Sisi and his supporters? So the Egyptians and the Jordanians are very much opposed to the Gaza plan. And, you know, we haven't had really much a chance to talk about this proposed Gaza plan, because I wasn't here when it was proposed. But I just want to say one thing for those people who think that President Trump's Gaza plan sounds ridiculous and could never be implemented. And I suppose that many of you are right, that it's probably not implementable in the way that has been proposed. But I think it's a very, very smart strategy for two reasons. First of all, because it's showing up the Jordanians and the Egyptians exactly what they didn't want to have happen. When the president says, we'll just bring them into Egypt and Jordan, he does it without even consulting anybody. He was so sure that they were just going to do it. And when asked what would happen if they don't agree, his answer was quite simple. Don't worry. They will manage. They will love it. They're going to do it. They're going to love this. It's going to be excellent. So he's not really addressing the issue of what happens if they stand up. But it does show the Egyptians and the Jordanians up, because if they have been seen as champions of the Palestinian rights up until now, when the money time comes and they've really got to come to the party to help out, they're nowhere to be found. So I think that that's the first important message that is coming out of this Gaza plan. I think the second message is that if you go to a huge extreme by talking about rehousing Gazans somewhere else and taking Hamas out of the picture, many of you might notice that the discussion about taking Hamas out of the picture is nowhere. Right now, everybody's very much focused on rehousing the Palestinians. So the fact that Hamas being taken out of the leadership is part of this plan almost seems not to be discussed, and therefore potentially taken for granted. That is a big achievement potentially, because he's kind of focused the discussion on something and removed the focus from something else, which is really critically important. So the fact that there is almost an acceptance that Hamas will not be part of the future picture, or at least there's no discussion about it right now, I think is a good achievement. One of the other things that I would just throw into this discussion is that the way that things are stacking up with Hamas still being in Gaza, or the alternative of asking Fatah, the Palestinian Authority, to take over rulership of Gaza. We've tried those ideas before. We've been in those movies and they have failed. So to try to go back to that particular narrative and to try to reenact those situations seems to me to be a dead end path that we're heading down. We already know that those are failures. We have to come up with another idea. And so Trump has done that, for better or for worse. And I challenge those people who are critical of the proposed Gaza plan, because it sounds ridiculous and probably is ridiculous. But I challenge those people to come up with an alternative which doesn't involve Hamas or Fatah taking over rulership of Gaza. And right now, I don't see any alternative plans.
Yeah, very, very interesting. And I just love the fact that he has just thrown out all conventional thinking. I just love the fact that whether this plan is rubbish or brilliant, I've got absolutely no idea. But the point is that he's just said, you know, what you've done until now hasn't worked. I'm going to throw in something completely different. And that makes people think differently, even if that isn't the way that it is finally resolved. Antony Roach, we do need to leave it there. Thank you, as always, wishing you a fantastic weekend, a Shabbat Shalom, and we'll catch you on Monday morning.
That Israel Report was brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you're based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.